Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Yogic Studies podcast. I'm your host, Seth Powell, and this is episode 21. In this episode, I'm joined by Dr. Philip Moss to talk about his upcoming online course and all things Sankhya philosophy. Listeners will recall that Philip was featured on an earlier episode, episode number 11. So if you want to hear more about his story and journey into academia and his incredible research and really pioneering work that he's done on the Yoga Sutra or the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, I encourage you to go back and listen to that episode. In today's conversation with Philip, we take a deep dive into all things Sankhya. What is Sankhya? How did it develop? Who were the major thinkers? How does Sankhya relate to yoga, philosophy, and practice? And then we preview the upcoming course, taking a look at the key text for the classical Sankhya tradition, the Sankhya Karika of Ishvara Krishna. And we discuss the ways in which it might be related to the Yoga Sutra of Patanjali and yoga more broadly. And then we do a bit of a rapid fire, asking Philip's just to give us his definitions and responses to unpacking some of the really key terms of the Sankhya tradition, ideas that folks in the yoga world or elsewhere might not even realize some of these ideas that have become commonplace in yoga, that they originate and can be traced back to these early Sankhya sources. So things like the gunas, sattva, rajas, and tamas, prakriti and purusha, the tattvas, and so much more. I really enjoyed this conversation with Philip, and as always, I learned so much from him. He's really a brilliant and humble scholar and really a wonderful person and teacher. And so we're thrilled to have him offer this new online course, this opportunity to engage in this kind of slow and textual study. So the course is entitled The Sankhya Karika, Stanzas on All-Embracing Insight. And we'll talk about why Philip translates the text in this beautiful way, which is somewhat of a departure from other interpretations of Sankhya, as you'll hear. The course runs from March 16th through April 15th, 2021. We're going to meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays for two weekly live reading sessions with Philip at 10 a.m. Pacific time. As always, these classes on Zoom will be recorded. If you're listening to this in the future, everything is available online for self-study. But if you're here with us prior to March 16th, we really invite you to join us for this special live online course. You can find out more and register at yogicstudies.com/YS-204. Okay. Dr. Philip Moss is currently a research associate at the Institute for Indology and Central Asian Studies, the University of Leipzig in Germany, where he works on a digital critical edition of the Nyaya Bhashya, a Sanskrit work on spiritual liberation through proper reasoning. His first book, originally his PhD thesis, is the first critical edition of the first chapter, Samadhi Pada, of the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, that is the Yoga Sutra, together with the commentary called the Yoga Bhashya. He has published extensively on classical yoga and Sankhya philosophy and meditation, Ayurveda, the relationship of Patanjali Yoga to Buddhism, and as well as on the textual tradition and transmission of the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. He is a member of the Historical Sourcebooks on Classical Indian Thought project convened by Professor Sheldon Pollack, to which he contributes with a new monograph on the development of yoga-related ideas in pre-modern South Asian intellectual history. Okay, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Dr. Philip Moss. All right. I am here today joined by Philip Moss. Philip, welcome back to the Yogic Studies podcast. It's really lovely to have you here. Good morning from California.
Yes, good afternoon or good evening from Germany. I'm very happy to join you again for a little conversation.
Yes, wonderful to have you back and a great excuse to have you back on the podcast. Just yesterday, we launched the enrollment for your new online course with Yogic Studies, which is going to be a deep dive into Sankhya philosophy and reading the Sankhya Karika. And so I wanted to have you back on here to preview and discuss this upcoming course and to really just kind of pick your brain about Sankhya and all things Sankhya philosophy. So first of all, thanks for offering this course. I think it's a really special opportunity for all of us to just have a deep dive into this text. And thanks for coming back on and being game for this conversation.
You're welcome. It's also very welcome opportunity for me to study Sankhya and the Sankhya Karikas in depth once more in preparation of this course.
So for somebody who maybe has been doing yoga for a little while, maybe they've heard of Sankhya, maybe not, what is Sankhya? How would you explain it to someone who doesn't really know much about this tradition?
Yes, it's a system of philosophy, of Indian philosophy, at least in its classical coinage. There are earlier currents of thought that are labeled as, or may be labeled of Sankhya, and that don't share all the characteristics with the mature or classical system. So your question, what is Sankhya, is not too easy to answer. I would say a fundamental characteristic of Sankhya is a process ontology based on an ontological dualism. Mm. That is, there are two kinds of entities in the world. That is spirits or souls, pure consciousness, inactive and receptive on the one hand, and on the other hand, we have the realm of matter, which is unconscious but productive. And this ontological difference, which explains the world as an interplay between these different ontological realms, is one of the fundamental characteristics of what I would say is Sankhya.
So when people speak of Sankhya and likewise yoga, and we'll talk in more depth about the relationship between Sankhya and yoga, but when people speak of this as a dualistic philosophy, this is what they're referring to, this dualism between consciousness and matter, Purusha and Prakriti. Is that right?
Exactly, yes.
And what does that really mean, though, if we unpack that further? Because it's almost just become this catchphrase of this dualism between the two. What does that really mean for Sankhya, that there is this fundamental separation?
Sankhya is a way of explaining the world, the universe, as being the result of these fundamentally two entities, two different entities. As you said, Purusha on the one hand, pure consciousness, and matter, dynamic materiality on the other hand. In our everyday experience, we don't experience the world as being built upon such dualism. We usually perceive the world as a unified whole and ourselves in it. But according to Sankhya, this everyday experience is a fundamental error. And as long as human beings are bound in this error, they experience their own existence as being subject to a huge amount of suffering. Mm. the correct analysis of the world, experiencing this ontological difference between Purusha and Prakriti, leads to the cessation of suffering, to escape from the shortcomings of the human existence. This ontological dualism is the result of a deeper analysis of the universe leading toward spiritual liberation, leading from into the insight of the difference between Purusha and Prakriti, and finally leading to the possibility of overcoming the illusion that the Purusha, namely consciousness, is bound in that it would be identical with matter, and that leads to separation of Purusha and Prakriti and to liberation of Kaivalya of Purusha from matter.
So what is the Sankhya Karika, this text, which is going to be the focus of this course?
Yeah, the Sankhya Karika is a so to say, the classical exposition of Sankhya philosophy. Sankhya philosophy in its mature coinage as it has developed in the time of the Gupta era, so around 400 or 500 of the Common Era.
Mm.
A very brief text. It just consists of 70 stanzas, or slightly more than 70 stanzas in various versions.
Mm-hmm.
A metrical text in a metrum called Arya, says itself that it's just a summary of a much more comprehensive text, a text called Shashti Tantra, which unfortunately nowadays is lost, and which would have had a complete account of this dualistic philosophy.
That's so interesting. So in the Sankhya Karika itself, the author at the end of the text, right, says that this, what we've just read, is a summary, sort of the essence of this much longer text, the Shashti Tantra, which we no longer have evidence of.
Yes, this is what he says. He says that he is giving a precise but very brief account of this much more comprehensive work, the Shashti Tantra, in which out of which he left some narrative passages and passages dealing with opposing philosophical views.
Yeah, that's a really interesting statement, and I think is important. You know, you've already been mentioning that there was this sort of proto-Sankhya and earlier Sankhyas, and then around 4th, 5th century, this sort of Gupta era text, the Sankhya Karika, is written. It understands itself as participating in this much older tradition. And so it's a representation of Sankhya that has become very authoritative, right? But not necessarily the only Sankhya. Is that right?
Exactly. I think quite safe to assume that there were as many Sankhya philosophies in the earlier times as there were ashramas where ascetics were practicing yoga and were discussing the structure of the universe. These philosophers in the early times shared a number of views, but may have differed in many, many details. And as long as there was no debate between Sankhya and other schools of Indian philosophy, like, for example, Buddhism, there was also no need for a unified system of thought that was coherent in each and every respect. But as we know, and in the Gupta times, there were fierce discussions between Sankhya and Buddhism concerning the question of which system of philosophy would give the most appropriate account of the structure of the universe and would most securely offer liberation from suffering. And under these circumstances, philosophical debates happened, And this pressure upon the Sankhya camp led to a much more rational formulation and much more coherent formulation of their own philosophical positions. And this is what we find in the Sakya Karika.
Mm. Now you translate the name of the text, Sankhya Karika, as really beautifully as the stanzas on all-embracing insight. I've never heard Sankhya, the term, translated like that before, but we decided to even name the course such because I think it's such a compelling rendition of the term. Can you tell us a little bit about this translation as stanzas on all-embracing insight?
If one opens handbooks on Indian philosophy, one finds various interpretations or translations of the word Sankhya. One very common translation is a derivation of the word Sankhya from the Sanskrit word Sankhya, which means number. And there we read that Sankhya is a system of philosophy, the adherents of which are very fond of enumerating. And this is also what we find in Buddhist sources, translations of the term Sankhya into Tibetan. They refer to the meaning of Sankhya as meaning number. Mm. But I don't think that this is a very convincing explanation, because I don't think that any philosopher would identify herself or himself as being fond of enumerating and of finding enumeration as the key towards spiritual liberation.
Mm.
So there is also another possibility to derive the word Sankhya by focusing on the verbal root kya, which means to perceive or to know, joined with the verbal prefix sam, which means comprehensively or complete. This is an explanation which Chakravarti in his introductory work on Sankhya suggests. And that would mean that Sankhyas are those philosophers that are convinced that it is possible to perceive comprehensively the world as being a system of interaction between the two realms of being, namely Purusha and Prakriti. And this is what I wanted to convey by suggesting this translation, the stanzas, that is the karikas of Sankhya, that is of all-embracing vision of the universe.
Mm. So, you know, listeners of this podcast, students of yoga, will know that Patanjali's Yoga Sutra is very indebted to Sankhya, and might know that the relationship between Sankhya and yoga is a very, very old one that predates Patanjali. What can you tell us about this sort of vexed relationship between Sankhya and yoga?
Yeah, the relationship between Sankhya and yoga is a difficult one, and one which has many different facets and aspects, I would say. So Sankhya and yoga appear as terms already in the big epic in the Mahabharata.
Mm.
As Franklin Edgerton has argued convincingly, they don't refer there in all likelihood to different schools of thought, mm-hmm. but they refer to theoretical reflection and to spiritual practice, two sides of the same medal, one could say, if one intends to reach spiritual liberation.
Mm.
When it comes to texts, as you mentioned, the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, that is the Yoga Sutra together with its oldest commentary, the so-called Yoga Bhashya, this work designates itself as a Sankhya Pravachana.
Mm-hmm.
That is, as the magisterial work or the magisterial teaching of Sankhya. So it claims to be an authoritative Sankhya work and an authentic work on Sankhya. And yeah, the same is true for the Sankhya Karika, which, as we said, claims to be an authentic summary of the Shashti Tantra, which is a more comprehensive and nowadays lost work on Sankhya.
And so
Sankhya and Yoga, they are very much related as theory and practice. But about the relationship, also the historical relationship between these two fundamental works, it's very difficult to come to any conclusion, because the Sankhya Karika, they don't mention Patanjali Yoga. Mm. And the Patanjali Yoga Shastra does not quote the Sankhya Karika. So it's not entirely clear which of the two works is the earlier one. Mm. What can be said is that the Patanjali Yoga Shastra teaches a Sankhya of a slightly different coinage than the Sankhya that we find in the Sankhya Karika. And scholars have argued that the summary that Ishvara Krishna gives of the Sankhya Karika is a very, conservative account of Sankhya, which is maybe leaving out some innovations that may have become popular at the time when Ishvara Krishna wrote this work or composed this work.
Mm. So the author of the Sankhya Karika is named Ishvara Krishna. What can we say about the author of this work? You just anticipated one of my other questions, which is there anything we can say about the relationship between Ishvara Krishna and Patanjali? Which sounds like not so much directly, but what, if anything, can we say about the author of the Sankhya Karika?
I would say we can say almost nothing about Ishvara Krishna. That's really problematic. The Sankhya Karika, they are quite enigmatic. We don't know exactly when the Sankhya Karikas were composed. The earliest fixed date is the translation of the Sankhya Karika together with a commentary from Sanskrit into Chinese at the end of the 6th century, around 560 of the Common Era.
That's quite interesting itself, this Chinese translation, which says something perhaps about the importance already of the text at that time, right?
Yeah, exactly. It says that Sankhya was a serious opponent of Buddhism. Mm. It was so serious an opponent that it was necessary for Buddhists to know about the system of Sankhya in some detail. And therefore, the Sankhya Karika, together with a commentary, were translated into Chinese.
So it was translated into Chinese only so that it could be defeated in Chinese.
I think so, yes. That was the purpose of translating it. I don't think that Paramartha, the translator, thought that it would have anything to contribute to Buddhism. No, it is an example of an erroneous teaching from the perspective of Buddhism.
Mm. And of course, the Buddhists are an example of an erroneous darshana or philosophy according to the Sankhyans.
Yes, that's what we have. That's the situation that we have in ancient India. There are different schools of philosophy, all of which claim that they have access to the best and only true account of the universe, according to which it is possible to overcome human suffering and to reach spiritual liberation.
Mm. And yet they have so much respect, we might say, for the opponent's tradition that they go to extreme lengths to study it very rigorously, to be able to articulate the opponent's view very precisely, even to translate the text from Sanskrit into Chinese.
Yes, it may have something to do with respect, but it may have also to do something to do with the political conditions at this time. So the debates that were held at that time were frequently sponsored by rulers. And the rulers may have functioned as judges in these debates. Mm. And those who were successful, who were victorious in the debates, they were presented huge amounts of gold, of wealth, which also then provided them with the opportunity to strengthen their community within the realm of these rulers. And those who were defeated frequently faced the fate of being expelled from the kingdom. Mm. So it was very, very necessary to know the arguments that the opponents could raise in the course of debate in advance in order to prepare oneself. And I think that these public debates were a major and driving force for the development of Indian philosophies at the Gupta time. Mm.
Back to Ishvara Krishna and the text's relationship with Patanjali and yoga. So they're both representing a Sankhya, but you mentioned that there are some differences in their philosophies or in the ways in which they're engaging Sankhya. What would you say, what's an example or what are some of the key differences between the Sankhya Karika and the Patanjali Yoga Shastra?
One key difference between the two systems of Sankhya is their respective view upon the mental apparatus, with regard to psychology. The Sankhya Karika, they teach that there are three organs or instruments that are needed in human beings in order to account for mental events. So that is the buddhi or the intellect, then ahankara, individuation, and then manas as the organ which organizes the sense data that are presented to it.
So these
whereas
three...
in Patanjali Yoga, we have just a single mental organ, which is called, most of the time is called citta, but also frequently manas or buddhi, without any clear distinctions between three organs that we find in the Sankhya Karika.
Mm. So you think when Patanjali is using manas or buddhi, he's using them somewhat interchangeably, and that, would you say then that when we're reading that those three divisions or layers of mental faculty, are we kind of projecting Sankhya Karika onto Patanjali and reading it through that lens?
I think so, yes. I have studied the Patanjali Yoga Shastra and looked at the different occurrences of the terms manas and buddhi. And I think that most of the time what Patanjali is talking about is in principle the citta, yes. He doesn't maintain the existence of different organs. I think it's a simplification that, according to the Yukti Deepika, which is a very informative commentary on the Sankhya Karika, but which we may or may not talk later on. According to the Yukti Deepika, that's an innovation that goes back to the Sankhya teacher Vindhyavasin. And Patanjali Yoga Shastra appears to be the coinage of Sankhya as it was developed by Vindhyavasin. And Ishvara Krishna apparently was unwilling to follow this innovation and this simplification, and remained conservative in this regard, and taught a threefold division of the mental faculty.
I think that's reminding me, I think perhaps that's some of the evidence for Gerald Larson's argument that the author of the Bhashya of the Yoga Sutra is not Patanjali, but Vindhyavyasan, the Sankhyan. Is that right? I know you disagree. I know you disagree with that position, but I think, is that Larson's? Is that his argument?
Yeah, I think, yeah, Larson makes this or claims that this is a real possibility that Vindhyavasin was the author of the Bhashya part of the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, and actually, that's a possibility. We have passages in the Yukti Deepika which refer to positions of Vindhyavasin that we also find in the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. Mm. We also have in a Jaina work an account which quotes the Bhashya and says that this was said by Vindhyavasin. So there's a connection between the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, the Bhashya part of the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, and Vidyavasin.
Mm-hmm.
But
that, evidence, that could have been, think, it could have been a source of Patanjali.
Maybe. I think I personally regard it as an open question whether it was Vindhyavasin or Patanjali himself who composed the Bhashya part of the Patanjali Yoga Shastra.
Mm.
When I look at the evidence as a whole, I find that the evidence for Vindhyavasin is comparatively weak compared to what we can say in favor of the authorship of Patanjali for the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. I mean, there are many things. We have the colophones. We have no mention of Vindhyavasin within the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. We have quotations from the Bhashya part in other philosophical works saying iti Patanjali. Mm-hmm. And this adds up, this evidence, and I think this is stronger than the Yukti Deepika joined with this one quotation from the Jaina work, which says that Vidyavasin was the author of the Bhashya part. But we have to remain open-minded and look for further evidence before we can come to a final conclusion. At the present time, I would say we have two real possibilities.
Mm.
One for which the evidence is stronger, one for which the evidence is weaker. We have a very strong evidence in both cases that the sutra and the Bhashya were brought together by a single person.
Sure.
And have to be viewed as a unified whole, whether this was Patanjali or Vindhyavasin.
Yes, I agree completely with that. Well, not to get too sidetracked on the authorship question of Patanjali Yoga Shastra, because we have a whole other podcast episode. We did, folks can go back and listen to that. But I think it's relevant in that regard. But back to the relationship between Sankhya Karika and Patanjali Yoga Shastra. One often hears and certainly reads in secondary scholarship this notion that Sankhya is an atheistic tradition, and the yoga tradition is theistic because of its inclusion of Ishvara and this important section on Ishvara in the Yoga Sutra. But we've talked about this a bit before, but this is a bit of an oversimplification, right? Does this hold up? Is Sankhya an atheistic tradition? Or what does the Sankhya Karika say or not say about this question?
Yeah. So first of all, it all depends on how you define atheistic in this regard. The existence of gods is, of course, nowhere disputed. No, gods which have individual capacities, limited power, in a polytheistic sense. So that's beyond doubt. And the question is there something like a one God, which is all knowing, almighty? Does this God exist or does it not exist? And what is its function, its role within this universe?
Mm.
And within the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, it's clear that Ishvara as a omnipotent and all-knowing God is mentioned. But in Patanjali Yoga Shastra, this God is just a special kind of Purusha.
Mm-hmm.
It is always an eternally liberated soul. And there is no qualitative difference between Ishvara and all the individual Purushas. And the Sankhya Karaka, they do not exclude the existence of such a Purusha. And it is also mentioned in the commentaries. The role of this Purusha within the universe is very, very limited within Patanjali Yoga Shastra, and it's also very limited, of course, within the Sankhya Karaka. Ishvara does not play any role for the creation of the universe. The universe is not created by Ishvara, and he is also not responsible for how the world works. So he does not interfere within the world very pronouncedly. Within the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, the role of Ishvara in the world is limited to the fact that Ishvara manifests himself, incarnates himself out of compassion for the suffering world, and then initiates the teaching of Sankhya in the world to provide the beings with a mean to overcome suffering. And so Kapila, the earliest promulgator of Sankhya teaching within the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, he is an incarnation of Ishvara. And I think that such a role is also possible within the system of Ishvara Krishna. So it's not justified to say that classical Sankhya is completely atheistic in such a way that it would deny the possibility of an ever liberated Purusha as being God or Ishvara.
Yeah, because at the end of the Sankhya Karika, there is a similar mention of the ways in which these teachings have been handed down, this knowledge, this jnana, that was passed down by what's the phrase, the supreme sage Paramarshin.
Yes.
And then it even kind of talks about how this was passed down out of compassion to Asuri and likewise to Panchashika. And then now this is being codified by Ishvara Krishna, a sort of parampara, if you will, even if it's kind of serving a literary device here. So that does strike me when one reads that alongside the Yoga Sutra, it is sort of similar to the Ishvara section, where he's described as the guru and the teacher of ancients, out of his compassion, is imparting the teachings of yoga or teachings of Sankhya. So is it fair to read this Paramarshin, the supreme sage, as somewhat of a parallel figure to this special Purusha Ishvara in the Yoga Sutra?
I think so very much, yes. This expression, Parama Rishi, also occurs in the Bhashya part of the Patanjali Yoga Shastra as a designation for Ishvara. So I would say that these texts are very much on par with it, or at least the Sankhya Karaka allows for such an interpretation. That Parama Rishi refers to the incarnation of Ishvara.
Yeah. So in thinking of whether or not these are atheistic traditions, it depends on how we define theism, right? And if we're holding up theism by a Western monotheistic model of a sort of creator God, then perhaps not. But that shouldn't be the only model for theism that we impose on these texts. And so there certainly is a role for a god or a lord, or these very accomplished and divine beings that even have the ability to bestow grace and teachings to individuals, but it might not fit into that monotheistic model.
Yes. The Ishvara not only does not play a huge role or any role at all in the creation of the universe, his role is the process of spiritual liberation. So spiritual liberation does not happen because of the grace of God. It happens because of a special insight into the structure of the universe. And each and every being has to proceed on the course towards this insight on his or her own accord and with her or his own responsibility.
Mm.
It implies a certain orientation towards spiritual liberation by means of a certain conduct,
mm-hmm.
Which is designated in the commentaries also of the Sankhya-Karika as yamas and niyamas, like in the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. So the earlier commentaries have a slightly different set of yamas and niyamas as we find it in the Patanjali Yoga Shastra. The later commentaries on the Sankhya-Karikas quote Patanjali in this regard, which may indicate that originally, at the time when the Sankhya-Karika and the older commentaries were composed, Patanjali Yoga Shastra did not have gained such a prominence that it would be the only source to turn to when it comes to yamas and niyamas, or a description of the ethics of an ascetic who aspires for spiritual liberation. But in later times, in Gaudapada Bhashya and other commentaries on the Sankhya-Karika, Patanjali Yoga Shastra is quoted on Sankhya-Karika 23.
Mm, that's really interesting. So you just kind of mentioned Gaudapada. So what are some of the major commentaries that have been written on the Sankhya-Karika, perhaps some of them that will be looked at in the course? And also, you can say a little bit about why are these commentaries important for us in understanding the Karikas? What was the role of commentary?
Yeah, so the Sankhya-Karika, as I already mentioned, consists of just 70 stanzas. And these 70 stanzas are set to complete account of the whole system of Sankhya as an explanation of the world. So if you want to explain the world as being an ontological dualism in which it's possible to attain spiritual liberation. In 70 stanzas, that means that you have to compress what you want to say very heavily, which means that you just can give a couple of key terms that you have to use a very condensed and compressed style of expression.
It's pretty remarkable just in that itself, right? This expression of the map of the entire universe expressed in only 70 stanzas.
That's absolutely remarkable, and it's very much on par with the idea of compressing knowledge within works of philosophy, like in sutra works. So a karika is basically very similar to a sutra, with the exception that karikas are metrical compositions, whereas sutras are prose compositions.
Mm.
So, yeah, and to come back to your question, because the verbal expression is so dense, it's absolutely crucial to have commentaries which unpack the meaning of the karikas, and which explain the wording of the karikas and the relationship between what is said and what is meant within the karikas.
Mm-hmm.
And we have 8 commentaries that are transmitted to the on the Sankhya karikas. And these commentaries, they fall into, I would say, two two or three different categories. So we have early commentaries, which unpack the Sankhya-karikas in a very similar way. They differ in some philosophical details, but on the whole, they are very similar up to the way in which they express themselves. So, a lot of these commentaries are obviously parallel, have parallel verdicts. And then we have one commentary which stands out a lot. That's the 6th century Yuktidipika, which tries to position Sankhya firmly within the realm of Brahmanical culture on the one hand, and to defend Sankhya against opposing philosophical views. So the Yuktidipika is the most informative commentary that we have on the Sankhya-karika, and this commentary goes much beyond what we find in other commentaries, and especially in other earlier commentaries. And another important and very influential commentary is the Sankhya Tattva Kaumini by Vachaspati Mishra, which was composed between 950 and 1000 of the Common Era. And I think that this is the most frequently read commentary on the Sankhya Karika by one of the most impressive intellectual figures of late classical or medieval Indian philosophy. Vachaspati Mishra wrote commentaries on many works of Indian philosophy, including the Yoga Sutra, or the Patanjali Yoga Shastra, that is Sutra, together with the Bhashya.
That's right.
So it may go a little bit too far to enumerate these 8 commentaries, but we will read extracts from the commentaries, or I will refer to the explanations of the commentary within the course that I give on yoga studies in order to unpack and to elucidate this very dense literary work, which is the Sankhya-karika.
Yeah, I think the commentaries for the non-scholar, the uninitiated, they can be a little bit intimidating, but having an opportunity to dive into the world of commentary is really diving into the living tradition of the Sankhya school to see the ways in which the root text was interpreted and wrestled with, and meaning is made and applied over time, and the ways in which it's positioned against the other schools, the ways in which interpretations differ. It really shows us this living conversation that I think then we get to participate in today as modern readers. What can we say about a sort of living tradition or school of Sankhya? The ways in which Sankhya might have been practiced, since the time of Ishvara Krishna, over the last 1500 years, what if anything can we say about this school of Sankhya?
Yeah, that's a good question. Spiritual practice is not very pronouncedly described within the Sankhya-karika. And it is referred to some degree in the commentaries. And there we can see that what the commentators had in mind was a spiritual practice which is very close to the spiritual practice of yoga. That means that it is a practice which is performed by ascetics who live the life of homeless ascetics and aspire within this ascetic environment to reach for spiritual liberation. But I also think that the Sankhya-karika had the purpose to explain the structure of the world, the so to say, the background, the intellectual background on which spiritual liberation is practiced, maybe also to lay practitioners and to convince them about the rationality of this spiritual practice, to attract them towards this way of thinking towards about the world.
Well, it was a very influential text and philosophical system. Obviously, we have these commentaries and traditions that continued to interpret it, but also the ways in which Sankhya philosophy and some of the key concepts and ideas, the kind of metaphysical maps that are laid out in Sankhya, the ways in which those influenced other traditions. Can you say a little bit about the influence of Sankhya on Indian thought, Indian society, other Indian traditions?
Yes. So Sankhya was not only very influential because it created a huge amount of literature on its own accord. So these eight commentaries that I mentioned upon the Sankhya Karika, it was also very influential because it was an opponent for other schools of thought who developed their in contradistinction to Sankhya. And Sankhya was also adopted and adapted in new religious and philosophical environments within in the tantras, in the Vaishnava tantras, in the Shaiva tantras. They have drawn Sankhya thought for the development of their own religious systems. They have continued to develop this over a long time. And because of this religious and philosophical developments, it has been argued that Sankhya is not just one specific school of philosophical thinking in India, but that it is the philosophy of India, which means that it's absolutely crucial to understand and to familiarize yourself with Sankhya if you want to engage intellectually with Indian religion and philosophy in general.
Definitely. On that note, there's so many key terms and concepts that are developed in Sankhya that become important for other traditions. I think today, even in the yoga world, there's so many terms that have become part of the lexicon of modern yoga, and folks might not even realize that they actually originate within this Sankhya philosophical environment. So what I'd like to do now is kind of rapid fire questions to you, Philip. I'm going to spit some terms at you. Your answers don't have to be rapid fire, but we'll try to go through kind of a number of these key terms. And I'll ask as much as possible, you try to give kind of a brief explanation of each of these terms, okay?
Okay, fine.
Now, some of them you've already mentioned in passing, but it's still useful, I think, to just talk about them straight on. So what is Purusha and Prakriti?
Yeah, Purusha is a pure consciousness. And I translate Purusha in my work on Sankhya as the subject. So it's the subject of experience, which is essentially free of all content of consciousness. The content of consciousness is displayed to the Purusha by Prakriti. And Prakriti is something that I tend to translate as primal matter. So Prakriti itself, in its undeveloped state, is something about which very little can be said because it does not have any properties. It's completely subtle. The only thing that we can say about Prakriti is that in it there are three fundamental forces or constituents or strings, the gunas.
Well, this is my next rapid question. What are the gunas?
Yeah, the gunas, there are three, as I said, forces or constituents of matter that are called sattva, rajas, and tamas, and they have certain properties, and the mixture of these forces leads to the world as we know it from primal matter, from prakriti, which becomes productive under the influence of purusha and develops to certain levels of reality that are called tattvas or principles.
What are the tattvas?
Yeah, so the tattvas are, as I said, levels of development from primal matter. So its first emanation is called Buddhi or Mahan, Mahat, the great. Mm. From this develops individuation, Ahankara. Ahankara then becomes the starting point for a development into two different directions. Under the predominance of sattva, the ahankara develops into the organs of action, the so-called karmendriyas, and the faculty of the sense faculties. That is, the ear, the eye, the tongue, the skin. So all these faculties with which we experience sense data and interact with the outside world. And under the influence of tamas, the ahankara develops into the tanmatras, into the so-called fine elements, which cannot be perceived, but they are the starting point for the gross elements out of which the universe, as we know it, the outside world, is finally made up.
So this is a theory of evolution or de-evolution, sometimes it's called?
It is called evolution, but I don't like the word evolution for this process, because evolution is a term that was coined by Charles Darwin as a process describing survival of the fittest.
Right.
And leads to the development of species on this planet, and this is definitely not what is meant with the process of emanation from prakriti into the different entities that we find in the world. So the term that Sankhya uses itself for this process is a parinama, transformation. Mm. Something which remains in principle identical with itself, changes its properties, and transforms into something new. And this is a generation of the world from prakriti by means of transformation, parinama, or modification, vikriti. Mm.
What is the buddhi?
Yeah, so the buddhi is the first transformation of prakriti. It is described in the Sankhya Karikas as something having the function of determining. So here we come into, we are confronted with a different or difficult question, namely, what does this process of transformation from prakriti into the world and into this several psychological organs actually mean? Mm. What is the level of reality that it describes? Does it describe the generation of the universe, or does it describe the generation of the psychological makeup of the human being? Right. And it is this question is, I think, difficult to answer. And sometimes Sankhya moves on the level of cosmology, and sometimes Sankhya moves on the level of psychology. So these two spheres of knowledge are sometimes difficult to differentiate when it comes to Sankhya. So, and yeah, the body is one of these three mental faculties or organs that Sankhya claims that exist, and its primal function is determining. The examples that are given is, this is a pot, this is a piece of cloth. So clearly identifying things, which of course are not already there at the first level of the emanation from prakriti. It's just the faculty that these determinations can be made later on when the process of transformation continues.
What is the ahankara, sometimes translated as ego?
It is called, it's sometimes translated as ego. Ahankara means the I maker, the maker of I am. I don't like the translation ego too much. I think a better translation is individuation. It's the principle which is responsible for the fact that there are individual entities in the world. And therefore, it is the starting point for this twofold emanation, one into the direction of the faculties that make up the human being, and on the other way, on the other hand, the entities of the outside world. And we have individual entities in the outside world. We have pots and cloths and wagons and whatever there is, shelves and trees, and they are there as individual entities because they are have developed from this principle of individuation, the ahankara.
Would you, to follow on that, I mean, just to put it kind of crudely, but does the Sankhya suggest then that this notion of differentiation of things in the world only takes place in the mind? If that bifurcation of individuality kind of begins at that ahankara psychological level, and then things evolve, if you will, or transform out from there. I've never really thought of it in this way, but as I'm listening, I'm wondering if that is the position here of the Sankhya Karika, that
For the Sankhya Karika, the world, the outside world, is real. No? Prakriti is real. There's no way to simply reduce the outside world to a mere illusion. It is there, and it has a purpose. The purpose of the outside world is either to feed the subject, the purusha, with data, and in this way to involve him within the cycle of rebirth, or to lead the purusha towards the opposite, namely to detachment and towards separation from prakriti, and to gain spiritual liberation or kaivalya, to gain autonomy. Yeah.
That was my final rapid fire question. What is kaivalya?
Yeah, so kaivalya is a term which is frequently translated as isolation, meaning the separateness of purusha from prakriti. I think that isolation has a rather negative or evokes rather negative association in modern day English, and this is the reason why I would avoid this term. I think it's being for itself and out of itself.
Right.
And this means being under one's own control, And this is what I want to confer by translating Kaivalya with autonomy, being out and for itself, being wholly itself, so to say, losing the limitations that human existence brings with it.
Yeah, I often translate it as independence, but I like autonomy as well. But something that has a more positive valence rather than isolation.
Yeah, that's why I would suggest it. Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, this has been really fun. We're going to start to wind down here. But to kind of close off this rich discussion, obviously there's so much more to discuss, but we got to save some for the course, right? So hopefully we can give people a good taste and flavor for this text and tradition. But hopefully, of course, there's just so much more to study. And that comes up when one reads the text closely and thoroughly, word for word, line for line. But why is the study of Sankhya and the Sankhya Karika in particular, why is it important or relevant for students of yoga? And what do you hope that students of this course will gain from studying this text?
First of all, I think that philosophy is important for everybody, whether he studies or practices yoga or doesn't practice yoga, because it requires to critically engage with the human existence, with what makes the universe, with fundamental questions of human existence. Why do we live? Where do we live? What are the conditions under which we live? So these are questions that are, I think, crucial and valuable for each and every human being. And of course, these questions can be addressed from various perspectives. And I think it's also very, very rewarding to engage with non-Western philosophy, with philosophies that have developed in different cultures by thinkers that are quite remote of our own living conditions, but which still share with us the condition of being human. Mm-hmm. So they may present answers to the question of what it means to be a human being that have been developed under different conditions, but which are still relevant for us, because these were thinkers that were struggling with being humans, and they were offering answers to fundamental human questions, as, for example, how is it possible to overcome human suffering? And this question is addressed right at the outset of the Sankhya Karika. And one of the answers that is presented in this regard is that thinking that there are means, technical means, to overcome suffering, that this is an illusion and is wrong, and that there are good reasons to assume that no technical solution will ever lead to overcome human suffering as a whole. And this is relevant, I think, also for the times that we are living in, where there are so many new developments within the realm of technique that are offering us liberation from suffering in the one or other way, but they are all very limited for reasons that already have been analyzed by the Indian thinkers at the classical period, and particularly by Ishvara Krishna in his Sankhya Karika.
Yeah, I always think that although our external conditions and culture and time and place has changed so dramatically since, if we think back to 1500 years ago of Ishvara Krishna's context in writing, but the inner human condition and the need to overcome suffering is the same. And yet, if one is not addressing that inner core question and human condition and the root cause of suffering, if they're just focusing on outer techniques or technologies or all these things, then it's not getting to the heart of the issue. So to read these texts that are really getting right to that core issue of the human condition, where the relieving of suffering is, as you said, put right at the forefront of the text. I mean, that's always struck me as one of the unique aspects of Indian philosophy, is that it's a very intellectual and academic tradition, but the alleviation of suffering seems to be a shared goal that really runs through the heart of the work of philosophy. So I think that's a really nice place to end our conversation today. I thank you for your time, Philip, and we really look forward to this course and opportunity to study the Sankhya Karika with you. For folks who are interested, the course is open for enrollment now. You can visit yogicstudies.com/YS-204. The course runs live from March 16th through April 15th, 2021. So we hope many of you can join us live. We're going to meet on Tuesdays and Thursdays at 10 a.m. Pacific time on Zoom. But of course, everything will be recorded. And if you're watching or listening to this in the future, and this is already passed, it's all recorded and will be available for self-study. So you can engage in textual study at your own pace. Philip, any final words before we part ways today?
Yes, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to read this important text with an interested audience. I'm very much looking forward to this. And I also would like to thank you very much for co-creating this special format of reading primal source material in translation, and in this way going to the very source of the text. And I think that that's a very much more rewarding approach of engaging intellectually with Sankhya than having a series of lecture about Sankhya. You know, we are going to the core, to the root work, and we are reading it and trying to understand this difficult and challenging work jointly. And yes, I'm very much looking forward to this.
And on that note, I forgot to make mention, one of the unique features of the course is that Philip is preparing his own translation in English of the Karikas as we go. So we'll be able to have a very, very fresh and lucid and reliable translation. Do you want to say anything, a word or two about that, Philip?
Well, the Sankhya system is a system that has been studied quite extensively, and there are quite a number of translation currents made by scholars of different quality. But I think nevertheless there is much to be discovered. There are many nuances that can be conveyed in a translation, and it's still a very challenging task to interpret this text and to provide a new translation of this, which is fun to do. And some of the better translation, or at least one of the better translations, is only available in German by Erich Vorweiner. So that provides some guidance. But I'm taking a new and fresh approach towards this task, and taking into consideration, of course, the explanation provided in the commentaries.
Yeah, that's right. Well, wonderful. Well, we really look forward to seeing that and to reading this text with you. So thanks so much for your time today. We'll talk more soon and see you soon for the course. And thanks, as usual, to our listeners. Everyone, please take care, and hopefully we'll have you on here again soon. Okay. Bye, Philip.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Yogic Studies podcast. If you've enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving us a review on iTunes or sharing this episode with someone else. Thanks so much, everyone. Until next time, please take care.